Hey, Chris Manning here. Today on Locked On Cavs, Dylan Stewart from Cleveland Magazine and I talked about the decision, the ESPN backstory documentary that aired on Sunday, and kind of how the decision is aged and how we think about it 10 years later. It's a really fun conversation, a really, I think, insightful one. Love to hear your thoughts. If you want to email us, again, I'm not using Twitter right now, so lockedoncavs@gmail.com. Email us there. Love to kind of chat with anyone if you have your own kind of thoughts on this. We'll read some of the best ones on the show, depending on, you know, if you guys actually submit them or not. So please just consider doing that and letting us know. A couple other just news and notes going on right now with the Cavs. In terms of roster stuff, we actually got some news. The team converted the contract of Dean Wade to a multi-year deal from a two-way deal, and Jordan Bell agreed to a two-year deal with the team. Neither are big financial commitments. Basically, they're still under the luxury tax line, and these deals are really structured, according to people that Evan and I have talked to, in more like Alfonso McKinney's contract. So basically, like, there is some money up front to get you in. It keeps you into a certain amount of time. And for Bell and Wade, this basically means like training camp next year. And then they could be cut after that. There's no guarantees. But I like the moves for both of them. There's certainly not guaranteed minutes for either of them. But if Bell is like your Ante Zizic replacement, that's all right. Wade is a stretch four, was in the G League this year, shot about 40% from three, is decently mobile. I think he's could be an NBA player. We'll see if he kind of pans out that way. I don't think it's a lock by any means, but I think he has some upside there. A lot of draft people I respect really liked him as well, so maybe there's something kind of there with Dean Wade, and I think the Cavs kind of did the smart thing by just locking them in now while you could before the league transaction window closes Tuesday. Get them in, get them for camp next year, and gives you some control over your roster as far as who's on it, who's going to be at camp, and all that stuff. But Evan and I will talk about that more, I'm sure, later in the week and dive into kind of their potential fits. We both wrote about them in Fear the Sword, so check that out. Check out the start of Rivalries Week at Fear the Sword as well. But today is the conversation about the decision with Cleveland Magazine's Dylan Stewart. We'll maybe have another one later this week kind of on the decision, considering we're about at that 10-year anniversary. But here's my conversation with Dylan. Thanks for listening, and talk to you again later in the week.
You are Locked On Cavaliers, your daily Cleveland Cavaliers podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Cleveland Cavaliers select Darius Garland from Vanderbilt University.
My. It's called the Kevin Love Show.
Kyrie Irving, he's gone. Xbox at him today at the Q.
On the blow block.
He put him in cement boots. Colin Sexton for two.
Joining me now is a good friend of mine. He's Dylan Stewart, runs social, does a bunch of web work over at Cleveland Magazine. There's a whole bunch of stuff over there. Dill, what's up, buddy? How are you handling quarantine?
I'm handling it pretty well. You know, it's nice. We had a very Cleveland spring where it was snowing and raining, and that I was kind of breaking down for a little bit there. But now that we have nice weather, I'm out in my hammock every day and soaking up the Cleveland sunshine. So I'm doing good. I'm loving it.
Yeah, Cleveland is nice. People need to like just know that for a fact. Cleveland's nice. The weather's good. It's better
at least for a few months a year.
Yeah, a couple months a year, and then in the winter, it's, you know, it's a little iffy. In the winter can get a little bit of a slog, especially if you have to drive anywhere, which is just garbage driving in snow. But we're going to talk about the decision 10 years later. You wrote a piece about the backstory with Don Vanetta thing that went up on Sunday. I thought it was really good. You can find the piece in the show notes below. But Dylan, what did you think of that piece? We're going to talk about a lot of little things here. I have some notes on some of the bigger stuff from it. But what did you think of the looking back at the decision 10 years later?
So I think looking back, like, we got a lot of things right about it right in the moment, and yet still 10 years later, I think, you know, especially this show, and thinking back to it, you know, you can kind of like, the show really recontextualized what we were seeing, you know. I really think that it's sort of this launch pad for specifically the LeBron that we know today, in terms of, you know, helping him find his voice, helping him kind of be this media personality, you know, probably not even budding. I mean, media mogul and yeah. things like that. But certainly, you know, I think it highlights the fact that even 10 years later, this was an uncomfortable, even 10 years later, even when, you know, we'll listen to 3-hour conversations on podcasts and things like that, this was not a well-produced program. It was an awkward moment. And I still do think, I mean, it goes down on LeBron's resume as really one of his worst moments. But it was a moment that kind of led to some of his best moments and really changed, I think, the power dynamic in professional sports in general, and kind of speaks to, you know, with COVID and stuff like that, interrupting all these professional sports seasons, you know, I think, and you see it even in baseball and things like that, I think it really speaks to so much of what we're seeing between the battle over the power dynamic between the players and the owners.
Yeah, and I think too I think it's a thing that Don Van Natta went out of his way to really make this about, and the way he ended the thing where he's talking about like the way we talk about sports and the way that players interact and have a say in how sports are talked about, how they are talked about. And like it's very notable that LeBron James, Maverick Carter, Rich Paul, Randy Mims, none of them are quoted in this. There's, you know, also Dan Gilbert's not in it, Jim Gray's not in it, you know, Pat Riley isn't in it. There's a lot of kind of parties that actually really like to kind of hear about. Pat Riley's kind of one just because he just is. I don't know if you watched The Last Dance when he showed up in his all-white drip and just looking like a lord. Like, I love Pat Riley for that alone. But, like, Dan Gilbert would be interesting to see upon, obviously. You know, I don't think he has a lot to gain by speaking, so I get why he wouldn't. And LeBron and Maverick talked about it through kind of their own channels that they've kind of gone to develop since then. It's just interesting to look back at this and think just how much has changed since and in the way we consume sports. Like, Twitter was such, like, barely a thing at this point, and now, for better or worse, it's just so much of how we consume a lot of things. You know, this would have been something that if it happened now, like, maybe, and this was, like, the presentation, like, maybe it's, like, live-streamed or something, or at the very least, like, the clip is just on Twitter, and maybe not as many people are going to, like, tune in to watch, because this was, like, primetime ESPN on television. I think when I think, I mean, Kanye is there the whole day. The whole thing is just weird. The quote that I think explains a lot of this to me, there's two I'll say. The one from first is from Bomani Jones. He said, LeBron was 25, which is just old enough to think you know what you're doing. Pretty notable there. And I think, too, John Skipper, the former head of ESPN, says this was fairly revolutionary at the moment. And I think both those things are really dead on. Obviously, I think, you know, they talked about how Leon Rose and others in LeBron's camp at the time kind of like hedged and were like, okay, there is some downside here. But they clearly learned from this. And the rollouts of his other decisions have been different. Everything is more close to the vest. It's more kind of on his terms in a lot of ways. And I think that all kind of stems from this, how this was received and everything that went into it. But it's interesting that some of the decisions of it doesn't matter anymore. I think the implications of it are honestly much more interesting to think about than like the actual ramifications of it 10 years later. Now it's just like, okay, it was kind of still a dick thing to do and the way he did it, but he ultimately won a title for the city anyway. And it's like, I don't think most people really care anymore that he did it, even though it's not like the best part of his resume.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do find it funny as, you know, it's revolutionary in the sense that you're 100% right. Like, LeBron James would not need ESPN to do this. And I think ESPN, by giving, you know, the unprecedented control over this program that ESPN gave to LeBron James, just showed, you know, how much ESPN understood that very soon LeBron James really wouldn't need them. I mean, the fact that they gave him the time slot he wanted, the reporter he wanted. I mean, they basically handed everything, all the reins over to LeBron James in order to get that exclusive. And today they could do whatever they wanted. They could give him 24 hours on ESPN. They're not getting that exclusive. And I mean, I think that's exactly why you don't see LeBron James and you don't see Maverick Carter in this, because they said what they needed to say without any sort of unfriendly editing, you know, any sort of even, I mean, it's barely an interview in most of that, more than an athlete clip, because they did it through their own channel. So, I mean, it really does. I wonder, like, what primetime television even means to, like, if that even holds any weight to, like, young people, maybe 10 years, you know, younger than us, because it's like, what is primetime television anymore? I mean, no one really even cares. And, you know, I think you're 100% right. It's more the kind of I think that if you're a media geek, this was more interesting than if you are a Cavs fan or a basketball fan or something like that, because it really feels like those are the sort of groundbreaking moments in terms of the implications that this had.
Yeah, Don Van Natta, just if people aren't aware, he's one of the top sports investigative journalists there are. He's done incredible work on the NFL owners along with Seth Wickersham. He has a book that he's writing with Seth Wickersham called, I believe it's called Powerball, about like the NFL owners and Goodell. And I can't wait to read that, because there's just going to be a lot of tea and like dumb rich people stuff in that book that I surely cannot wait for. I think just the, as a note on this to kind of cap off our first little segment here, like when they mentioned that Stuart Scott or Bob Lee and as like potential other people that ESPN wanted, but Jim Gray, who as you mentioned did not work for the network, like is the LeBron's camp choice, comes in and he asks like weird questions, like are you still a nail biter?
Yeah,
all that stuff. Like if you get Bob Lee, would be kind of the one where like I think you would like you open yourself up to like really good questions and stuff like that, and I think Stuart Scott would have done the same thing, probably a little bit more kind of cordially and friendly. But I just think like, if there would have been, if LeBron would have, and he never would have done this, even in this, but if he would have just allowed himself to, like, be questioned a little more on the spot, I think that would have made this more interesting. But obviously, this, I think the fact that it doesn't happen says a lot as we go forward.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, this might have shown them that you really do need, you still need a storyteller in the room. You still need to, you can have your own show, but it needs to be, there's a reason shows are produced and that there's a script and things like that, because man, it is awkward. I mean, even when LeBron finally, you know, utters those infamous words, I'm going to take my talents to South Beach, which, you know, as a side note, I find really in the ongoing, like LeBron as a basketball historian, I had never heard of that Kobe Bryant moment. Where he's, I'd never really, I guess, seen his announcement on video of.
Yeah, you and I were both like 5 years old when Kobe would have announced.
That's a really good point. So that's probably why. But you know, I mean, LeBron, he's older than us. But yeah, regardless, I think that was a really interesting. There's a lot of small little tidbits that I think are really interesting, and that's just another one in the sort of LeBron as like a basketball historian moment to like think. And I think maybe he thought that everybody would just pick up on that right away. And it was such a weird way to say it. And as they describe in the show, very inelegant. But when he says that, like, I don't think people totally knew what to do. Like the crowd doesn't even clap. And I don't know. It's just, it was just very, it's just a very awkward hour of television.
Yeah, it's bizarre. Everything about it's bizarre. A lot of the commentary about LeBron after is like really bizarre.
What he's wearing? Like,
oh, terrible fit.
Yeah,
really bad
awful
fit.
Like the undershirt sticking out. And I mean, oh my God, LeBron today he'd be in his suit with the shorts or whatever. I mean,
it's that fit is up there with like the losing in Boston in 2010 and then losing to the Mavs in 2011 as far as LeBron mistakes go in my book. That fit's terrible.
Draft day.
That, I mean, look, 2003 was just a rough time for everyone. Like,
that's one of my favorite pictures, all of them in those ill-fitting suits.
Oh yeah, it's just the all white is It's incredible. All right, we're going to take a quick break here, but before we do that, I want to let you know about a sponsor of today's show, and that's Rock Auto. If you are a car person, rockauto.com can help you out. Or if you need a car part, rockauto.com can help you out. Rockauto.com is a family business serving auto parts customers online for 20 years already. Go to rockauto.com to shop for auto and body parts from hundreds of different manufacturers. They have everything from engine control modules and brake parts to tail lamps, motor oil, and even new carpet. Whether it's for your classic or daily driver, get what you need in a few easy clicks delivered directly to your door. Best of all, rockauto.com prices are always reliably low and the same for professionals and do-it-yourselfers. Why spend twice as much for the same parts? Spending more. Dumb. Go to rockauto.com right now and see all the parts they have available for your car or truck. Right, Locked On in their How Did You Hear About Us box so they know we sent you. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need. rockauto.com. Again, use Locked On in their How Did You Hear About Us box so they know that we sent you. Support them for supporting us. Dylan and I will be right back. Let's talk about Dan Gilbert right after this. All right, Dylan, I just want to say, maybe the only thing that has aged worse than LeBron's fit is Dan Gilbert's letter.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, certainly, I think... This is coming out in a time where I think we are all rightfully so hypersensitive, hyper aware to sort of the racial connotations of every single thing. And I mean, you know, the racial connotations in Dan Gilbert's Comic Sans letter are not hidden very well. They're not underlying.
In a 2020 context, especially for, we should note, two white men, they're much more prevalent to me now. And the way Mike Wilbon describes it in the backstory, and I know it seemingly LeBron felt, and I know, like, we know that his wife and his mother were not thrilled with him going to take paychecks from Dan Gilbert again when he came back. This in 2020 would have been, I feel like, just, it was really bad then. Like, I don't think anyone was like, this was good. I can't imagine how this plays in 2020, considering that people are, right, as you said, like, I think correctly more attuned to sensitivities and tonalities and, you know, not having that plantation type mentality as an owner.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you can't really say it better than Michael Wilbon does. You know, and he says white America didn't want to see him controlling this. You know, it goes back to that plantation mentality. I found it fascinating. It's something that I don't think I was mature or educated enough to understand at the time, but that Black America, you know, it really saw this as a much different event. It was something to be celebrated. It was something. It was LeBron taking control of his narrative, of the situation, of all of those things. And I really found that element of it fascinating. And I mean, I don't think that this holds the same weight per se, but I don't think that Cleveland's reaction to it aged very well.
No,
I mean, you still see the jersey burning here and there on so, you know, social media and stuff like that. I mean, it's even become a meme where they're about to burn the jersey and they throw like a thank you letter on the jersey or whatever. But like, you know, I think luckily for Clevelanders, the Dan Gilbert letter quickly overshadows how bad it was. But I mean, that was uncomfortable, especially, you know, with LeBron coming back years later to win the city a championship, with LeBron with the I Promise School, you know, I mean, and all the scholarship money that he's donated to local kids. I mean, you can't say that the guy does not respect the community. I think it was a tone deaf way to go about what he did. I don't think that changes, but I was sitting a little uneasy watching some of those middle fingers and jersey burning clips.
Well, number one, Dan Gilbert, notably from Detroit. Not that, like, he's not, like, invested in Cleveland for his own profits in a lot of ways, but, like, you know, LeBron's, like, actually from Ohio, so.
And Dan Gilbert has a lot more money than LeBron in his.
And it is notably, like, hanging out at the White House, you know?
Yeah,
like,
and has let's just the level of charity that LeBron James
Yeah, LeBron
has.
Is, like out here dealing with stuff, and Dan's like, wow, the best player that I ever, that my team lucked into draft had is leaving. I'm gonna like act like this is a problem, and it did upset. I mean, it is in the context of the time, like pre a lot of player empowerment, pre a lot of player movement that we see now, and I'm certainly sure that was like unsettling to people. I don't like remember following sports in exactly the same way and thinking about it in the same way as now, because I was like a 16-year-old idiot at the time, probably thought very differently about LeBron. But I mean, even the game that where he comes back, they don't really show it in this. But when I've gone back and read about it and like heard people of color that were there and talked about it, it's not like the most. It's another really, really bad look. Like that was very charged in a way that's really uncomfortable. Pretty low, like up there in terms of some of, I think, the worst looks for Cleveland sports fans. And I get, like, you wanting to, like, boo LeBron and stuff, but, like, the tone of it is just, like, so, it just, all the tone around LeBron after this, and there's, like, a really bad Bill Simmons column you can find, even though he, like, apparently pitched this and stuff, and there's just, like, a lot of weirdness about how LeBron was talked about when he did this in a way that is just, like, it's kind of remarkable he, like, decided to talk to anyone again after this in a lot of ways. You know what I mean? Like, it's sure. Kind of crazy.
And I mean, for anyone listening to this and feeling defensive, the reason I felt so queasy about it was I know that I was not out in the streets burning jerseys. I can say that. I actually still have my LeBron 1.0 Cavs jersey, but I guarantee I cheered it at 16 or 17 years old.
I
quoted or you know, in some way supported Dan Gilbert's letter, and I probably, you know, and I'm sure I know that I booed LeBron when he came back to Cleveland a year later. So I mean, I think that's part of if this, you know, I think this documentary accomplishes a lot of things, but for me, as a for the real Cleveland angle, what does it mean as a Clevelander? To me, it made me kind of look back at my own behavior. You know what I mean? And yeah, and Bill Simmons is another one who comes off looking a little bit weird, but I don't know. That's neither here nor there.
Yeah, there. You can just go read the Drew McGarry column about Bill Simmons. And Ziller had a good point in his newsletter that I'll forward you after this. But it's interesting. But I guess like with Dan, it's interesting that I think to wrap the kind of the Dan talk here. When he comes back, I didn't write down who said this, which is bad note taking on my part. But it was he saw it as Dan Gilbert working for him when he comes back, and I do think that is where we are. And mm-hmm. One of the things that is unknowable right now in 2020. Is like if and when LeBron owns the team, that dynamic in his mind will surely change to some degree. You would imagine, and I wonder what that kind of looks like, considering he was a guy who was so revolutionary in kind of getting players kind of what they wanted. And I just don't know what LeBron, the owner, looks like in kind of thinking about it in that context.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it will take, you know, a new generation of owners, because I think as we see with, you know, as I kind of brought up earlier, the discussion around how a lot of these leagues are going to handle COVID. I mean, I don't see a lot of instances where the players really got their way, you know, in most of these leagues. But it certainly seems more like they are meeting head to head, I guess. It seems like progress has been made, but you're right. It'll be interesting when, you know, people of LeBron's generation and stuff like that, if they are able to, you know, maybe make it look like an ESOP program a little bit more than, you know, than a, you know, the whole you work for me thing.
Yes. All right. We're going to take one more break here, come back and talk about sort of how we think we sort of remember this now right after this. All right, so Dylan, I'm just going to give you the floor here. When you watch this, you think about this. What to you is the real legacy of the decision? Is it the awkwardness of it? Is it the kind of the argument Don Van Ned, I think, is really laying out in there in terms of how it changed storytelling. What to you is the legacy of the decision all this time later?
I think that question depends on who you ask. For Clevelanders, the legacy will always be this: it a slap in the face. It will, you know, the Scott Rabb quote.
All due respect to Scott Rapp, let's get another avatar for Cleveland sports fandom.
Fair enough. Someone who's lived, you know, in Cleveland in the last 30 years. Yeah.
Yes.
That's about as far
no
as
shade,
you're
but like,
me
I'm
go.
Just, no
again.
Shade, like, you know, icon in a lot of ways. That's the Scott Rapp Cleveland conversation is for another day, but continue.
Yeah. And I would definitely love to have that because I love me some Scott Rapp. You know, he was very, very important read for me. But, you know, I think what he represents really well in that documentary is the sort of stereotypical, you know, and I would maybe even go so far as to say older, but I think that's a little too simplistic. Cleveland fan, you know, who will always look at the decision as, you know, quote, someone taking a huge dump on a city that I love. And I think, you know, a lot of those people, if we do want to put it on age, though, I think that's too simplistic. I think a lot of people, young, as Clevelanders, will always see it as somebody taking a dump on their city. But, you know, those are people who live through Letterman jokes, but late night jokes about, you know, Cleveland, as our mayor put it recently, being perceived as the butthole of the world. And, you know, I think that they are still so defensive about that, you know, and I just don't, I think in Cleveland, it'll always be looked at as this, slap in the face, as LeBron's worst moment. But I think that's very much softened by 2016. But, you know, in terms of media, I think, like I said, I think it's a huge turning point. I mean, I think it showed, I think it's one of the, it showed the price of an exclusive. It's a really great example of pointing at a time when exclusive journalism became more important. You know, I mean, than anything else, than you know, journalistic integrity, or if you want to call it that, or whatever, you know. And I think if you're talking to a media geek instead of a Cleveland fan, I think that is the legacy for that person or for those people is, you know, just sort of the idea that the personalities very quickly became people who could control their own narrative, who could tell their own story, and who could, you know, kind of take some of the power back. If you're not those two people, I don't really know why you needed to revisit this event, to be honest, or what this would mean to you.
Yeah. I think the legacy is just, it's just something that we are not going to, like, you know, think about forever. Like, it just isn't something where you and I or anyone else is gonna like talk about like forever and ever and ever, because there's just not really a need to. I think for me, the legacy is just, I think it's really in line with Van Ed argued in terms of just the where we're heading with storytelling. And I think I'm of two minds on this. Number one, I am very sympathetic and very open to the idea that players should tell their own stories. I think it's really interesting. I think there are certain experiences that, especially when like so much of the press corps is like white men, that you're going to get better perspectives if you can have people of color who grew up differently, who have much different experiences in life than I do as a white person, that you can share those authentically. I think that's really good. The other part of it that I think is potentially a little bit not, I think for if you're a public that wants to learn about players, and learn about stuff. And I think Vanata's point is, like, we just have to work harder, and I think that's right. I think the kind of stuff you're – like, it's very interesting that, like, Lee Jenkins, who wrote the LeBron letter, is maybe the one of the best sports feature writers of the last, like, 10 years and probably ever, and now, like, works for an NBA team. And I wonder – and, like, his breed of writer just doesn't quite exist as much as it did even a couple years ago. And I think that's a little bit of a shame, and I think that means we're going to have to do things differently and attack things in different ways in sports and movies and all that stuff. And it obviously won't apply to every player, like, not like, you know, like if Dylan Windler or Dean Wade or, you know, even like Colin Sexton, like, decides to open his own production studio tomorrow, like, it's not going to matter in the same way like LeBron doing it. But you will see guys selectively choose when they want to talk and selectively choose, like, you know, how they kind of approach things and how they want to share themselves. And I think social media allows for that. I think there's just a lot of different ways. And I think this is the tipping point of it. But I think we're still very much in the middle of a time where sports media is changing in a lot of different ways. And I think some of the control back to the players is very fair and very good, and I can understand it. I want to see how I respond to it. I want to see how people that do kind of what we do attack it in different ways. I want to see what that kind of results in as well, and kind of see, you know, if there is some, what kind of the middle ground in those two sides kind of collaborating looks like. I don't really know.
I do think one really interesting point, though, is that, you know, you mentioned the LeBron James letter, and you know, when we go, even with the things, you know, the uninterrupted and the more than an athlete, and I think what you see in that, in the production of the decision, is somebody who was not really prepared to open themselves up, and who was not prepared to have a real strong voice, and who, like, storytelling will still win. Yes, he's being selective in what he chooses to admit, but, and same with Maverick Carter and things like that in the more than an athlete thing, where they, you know, they sit down on the couches and they rewatch the decision and they talk about it. But LeBron James learned in that moment that he was going to have to let people not like him. He was going to have to open himself up, and ESPN could have the exclusive, and it worked for them. I mean, it's one of the most watched programs of all time, and they had, I think, at its peak, 13 million viewers. But it was so boring because LeBron James wasn't giving up any of himself. He was trying to say nothing. And, you know, so that's why the storytellers will always play such an important role in getting deeper with these players and helping them if they don't have their own voice, which the next day LeBron seems to develop as he leans into being the villain with the not one, not two.
Well, but it's even interesting with that. It's like, it's kind of clear when you go back and watch some of the stuff with him and kind of how he really has acted every day of his career. That didn't even feel real. Like, he actually liked doing that.
Right. Right. But yeah, I think in general it, you know, it just shows that you do need to, you're not going to please everyone. And if you want to give boilerplate responses, the classic post-game sports responses, no one's going to be interested in that, even if you're LeBron James. And I think that's the other thing, is he is LeBron James. We have to remember what an enigma he is. And 99.9, yeah, one of one. I mean, Kevin Durant's not LeBron James. I mean, Tom Brady's not LeBron James. There's nobody that is LeBron James. So, you know, I do think that we have to remember that, like, yes, it means a lot for everything from player empowerment to his relationship with his owner, as well as, like, someone telling their own story. But that, like you said, that doesn't mean Colin Sexton is going to launch his own production company and people are going to give a crap about what he has to say, because this is LeBron James.
Yeah, I can't think of how many athletes really could do it and do it at a level that is, like, sustainable in a lot of ways. It's like LeBron, you know, I'm sure, I mean, Tom Brady seems to be doing some of his own stuff, although I don't really know if, like...
But he's not as interesting.
No, Tom Brady's the most boring human being in the world. I can't think of, like, a ton in sort of like your traditional American sports that could do it. I think there are like some examples and guys in Europe that in soccer that could do it, like Messi could do it, but he's incredibly private. So it was Ronaldo and all that. And their access, like access is just sort of like cut off. There's a really good Brian Curtis piece at The Ringer kind of about like how hard it is for these guys to get access and stuff in Europe. I think you're right in just the boilerplate quotes. Like it's something that makes Darius Garland like sort of an enigma to me because like he just doesn't like give really interesting answers in post-game interviews. Drummond does the kind of the same thing, and when he's done like, but then it's like at the same time in Detroit he did these like little snippets of, you know, Dre's post-game thoughts, and it was like 50 seconds and he said nothing that he didn't say in his boilerplate post-game quote. So I'm just like, what are we doing here? Like, what, this isn't adding anything. If you're gonna like do your own thing, at least like try to do something different, you know?
Right.
And that's not everyone's skill set, but that, like, I don't know. It's just, it's an ongoing complicated thing, and it's going to be real interesting to see how it plays out. Do you have any kind of final thoughts here, Dylan, as we wrap up?
No, man. I think we kind of talked about it. I think there are a million little moments that we could unpack. I mentioned the Bill Simmons weirdness. If you're interested in that, I would watch for that. I thought the Kobe.
It's so weird, especially when you go and think about the column he wrote after the fact.
Yeah, like he just comes off as such a hypocrite, man. And then, you know, I think the whole Broussard saying there might have been a moment on the plane where LeBron reconsidered and went back to Cleveland. No. No, that was never going to happen. Even if Cleveland celebrated. Like, I don't know. I thought that was weird. There's a lot of interesting tidbits. I thought it was a decent watch. Again, I don't think if you're not a media geek or a Cleveland fan, I don't see why you necessarily need to sit down and watch this. But in general, I think it did a really good job of just recontextualizing the moment as being a lot bigger than just LeBron's biggest mistake, which it's still hopefully, I mean, we've had a lot of celebrities disappoint us, but you know, is very likely to go down as LeBron's biggest mistake forever and ever. But with the championship, it's not a very big one, so no one's really ever going to care.
Yes, the last thing I will just say is I want more info on what Kanye West was doing this whole time, this whole day.
Yeah,
because this is like Kanye before he like lost his mind.
I wish you would have seen some Kanye bravado in LeBron James' performance.
Because like, it was not there.
No, it was not there. I mean, they said that he was eating, they had a big buffet, like, right before
What was in the buffet? Who organized it? Like, did Kanye pick? Like, I just have a lot of questions.
Oh, I'm sure it was Swanky. Yeah, I don't know. I'm thinking steak. I'm thinking lobster. I'm thinking fried chicken and... I mean, it's just close to dinner time now, so I might just be getting hungry myself. But, you know, my thought is maybe, you know, Kanye and LeBron just got so stuffed from that buffet that, you know, it was kind of like a Thanksgiving, after Thanksgiving dinner situation, and LeBron was just completely out of it.
I love that theory. He's just, like, overstuffed.
Yeah.
And, like, give himself time to, like, didn't have, like, a post-dinner walk. He just sat there and was just like, oh.
He didn't sit on the golden LeBron throne, if you know what I'm saying. Before he
just
walked
didn't,
out
didn't
there.
Take the nice like 10 minute after dinner walk just to like get everything moving a little bit. Didn't have any like warm water with lemon just to kind of like help flush out the system. Just was like, I'm gonna sit here with all this food. I buy that. I could buy that.
Belly full of steak and potatoes, probably.
I want more understanding of how Kanye West got involved in all of this.
Yeah, we need a transcript of that dinner, 100%.
Leak it to me, please. And especially because Jim Gray was there too, and that just seems like a really weird like trio of people to be like hanging out in a small house.
Yeah. Oh my god, there was another great Jim Gray moment where he's like, he turns to Maverick Carter, who's handing him questions, and he's like, you really want me to ask this?
He's like, they were submitted by people online. Yeah, it was amazing. Amazing. Oh my god. Dylan, thanks again for coming on and doing this. I appreciate it. Give everyone just a plug on what you're doing at CM. And also, Dylan's in a great band called Astro Radio. They should go
check. Wow. Yeah.
Free plugs all about, my man.
Yeah,
free plugs.
I appreciate that. Yeah, man. I appreciate you having me on. Cleveland Magazine, we actually just launched the July issue this month, which is about camping, you know, having a little summer fun while being socially distant. We've been ramping up online. You know, we got a great Instagram account at Cleveland Magazine. If you like food, if you like just pretty Cleveland sights, and if you like knowing what's going on, we're all about that. And yeah, man, we're pumping stuff out every day. So give us a follow, subscribe. I think you could subscribe for like 20 years for like 30 cents. It's super duper affordable. So get on that and subscribe and get it in the mailbox. I'm still, even though I'm our digital editor, I'm still a big believer in print magazines. There's nothing like holding it in your hand. So yeah, I appreciate you having me on, man. Anytime you need me, I'm here.
Yeah, Dylan's one of one himself. it's a pleasure to have him on. Everyone will be back. Deb and I will be back later this week with a bunch of. He's got a draft pod coming up with Locked On Bulls and Locked On Hawks, I believe. And then we'll have the book club on Friday, and all kinds of stuff coming up too. And thanks for listening. On the way out of here, be on the lookout for a tease of one of the other great Locked On podcasts, Rejecting the Screen, and check that out. Support the other Locked On shows, and thanks for listening. We'll be right back.